I always talk about rewatchability. If afterwards I say to myself, would I want to go see this movie? Virtuoso filmmaking by Scorsese. It's some of the best work he's done.
Cinephile, the Adnan Virk Movie Podcast.
On the previous Cinephile, I said never underestimate the audience. The lesson after last week's Cinephile, never underestimate Stanzik. Because when he wants to bring the heat on a quiz that nobody will get, he will do so. The previous Cinephile quiz, we had 10 correct answers in 20 hours and a total of 15 that were still trickling in. On the last episode, Stanzik dialed up an absolute doozy, which nobody got right. And here is what is perhaps more telling than anything. Now, I get the fact we released the last episode on the election, so I don't know what the numbers were. Maybe people didn't listen to it. I love Matt Atchity. If you didn't listen, you're missing out. Rotten Tomatoes, I thought it was a terrific interview. And my brother actually said he thought it was one of our better episodes. So maybe just people didn't listen to it as much. That's fine. But here's what's more telling is that nobody even attempted the quiz. And in fact, a couple of people tweeted me going, hey, dude, I listen to the podcast all the time. I'm a huge fan. There's zero chance I would get this right. What the hell is your voice dancing to me? I said, what he's doing is he's following my orders, which was, listen, we had a too easy quiz before, so we had to make it harder. Now we figured it out. Happy medium.
That's it. We just got to find the happy medium. The first one underestimated the audience this time. Maybe we overestimated a little bit.
I think the hardest question was, what movie did I see for $5.23 in Iowa? That was when the people go, you know what? Screw that. I don't need a shirt, buddy. This is way too much work. Have to listen to your stupid podcast to find out what movie you saw in Iowa. Why were you in Iowa? And why were you spending $5.23 to go see a movie? Anyways, we'll get another quiz maybe next time. We'll figure it out. But thank you for all your feedback, as always. This is a great Cinephile coming up. The great Billy Bob Thornton, one of my favorite actors. And as you'll hear in this interview, if you kind of like him a little bit, don't know a lot about him, I think if you listen to this interview, you're going to love the guy, because he is candid. He's insightful. Honest, he's funny, he's self-deprecating, he has all those things wrapped up into one terrific package, and his acting over the years has proven what a great actor he is. But like I said, once you listen to this interview, we talk about Sling Blade and all the wonderful films that he's made. So take a listen to Billy Bob Thornton, and then I will tell you a couple of tidbits about him off the air. Stanzik and I had some interaction with him, which is also interesting because he had a bit of a rap, I think, from some as being a tough interview. If you Google his name, particularly look up an interview he did in Canada, it's like, oh, my God, Billy Bob Thornton, he's a tough interview. And, in fact, Ryan Russillo, who also interviewed him when he came to ESPN, was like, yeah, I did some research, and I was like, this guy's a terrible interview. Like, I'm really worried. And he was sensational with Ryan. And, in fact, he was great on all ESPN platforms. So I asked him about it, and I'll tell you what he said to me after. But first, take a listen to Billy Bob. You're listening to Cinephile, the Adnan Virk Movie Podcast, and a real thrill to have one of the best actors alive here with us in studio, Billy Bob Thornton. Great to see you, man. I've been a fan of yours for so many years, and what was really cool about all of this is that when I heard you were coming, I got to go back and revisit a lot of your classic films. And I want to ask you first and foremost about One False Move, because I remember I didn't know anything about you, and that was the film that, to me, introduced me to you. You wrote the script with Tom Epperson, and I remember Siskel and Ebert's review. They were like, you have got to see this film. And I was 13 years old, came out in 1991, and I said, well, what's so special about this action thriller? And I went back and I watched it again last night. That first scene where you hogtie the woman and you're threatening to light her on fire, like it comes out like gangbusters. And the greatness of that movie, for those who haven't seen it, it's not only a thriller, it's a commentary on race. It's a commentary on city versus country. It's about family. Like it's an extraordinary movie. And I'm just wondering, for you, when you have memories of One False Move, what stands out to you?
People didn't want us to use that title because there were several movies in the catalog, you know, over the years called Hurricane. Mm-hmm. And then it was called Star City. And then finally, one of the studio guys named it One False Move. We didn't even title it. And,
wow.
And at the time, we thought it sounded kind of like a B-movie title.
Right. It sounds like a you know generic thriller. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And we weren't crazy about the title. And, it worked out okay. But you know, Carl Franklin, who directed the movie, Carl is a terrific actor's director. And so I was really happy to be with a good actor's director early on like that because, you know, some people get with the wrong people and develop bad habits.
Right.
And I think he did a great job on it. And you're right. The movie is about a lot of different things. It's the kind of movie, because the independent film business is pretty much done for right now. Mm-hmm. It's all on TV. You either do event movies for the studios or you do Amazon, Netflix, whatever. And that movie and Sling Blade and Monsters Ball, Man Who Wasn't There, a lot of movies that I've done over the years, probably either wouldn't get made now or would get made for a couple of $1 million and nobody would ever see them.
Yeah, you dovetail perfectly to my next point, which is 20th anniversary of Sling Blade this month. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine you trying to sell someone on that movie. Like I have, right. I was trying to tell someone, I'm like, well, it's about this slow-witted guy who gets released and befriends his kid, ends up killing a guy because he's an abusive father, and he ends up back where he belongs. I'm like, wait, what?
I'm like, exactly.
Oh, yeah, like what? Yeah. How could you sell this movie? But yeah. And I think people forget, Billy Bob, they think you won the Oscar for acting, but it was the screenplay.
Right.
Because you had come up with a story. Some folks called it Kaiser Blade, some folks called it a Sling Blade.
Right.
But how were you able to make that movie in 1996 and have it transcend, like you said, beyond just this independent bubble?
Right. Well, you know, from the late 80s through the late 90s, there was sort of an independent film renaissance period. It was a really rich time for independent film. And, you know, Miramax had a lot to do with that. And it was a time when those were sought after. Those, you know, somebody wanted the next real edgy, you know, sort of anti-hero and also, you know, indie feeling, rough edged kind of movie, you know. And I sold that movie to the first people I talked to, really my agent over at William Morris. He just said, hey, there's this guy, like they were production assistants and now they're, you know, parents, got, you know, gave him some money to make movies with. They had made one movie, I think, before Sling Blade for like $60,000.
Wow.
And something that I don't even know if I've ever said it publicly. I've told friends of mine. But one of the things about Sling Blade is that they didn't have all the money. They said, this is going to be our first $1 million movie. Mm-hmm. They said, we can't pay you as a director or anything. But, you know, we have to pay you as an actor because of union stuff, but I wasn't in the DGA yet. Mm-hmm. But what we're doing is we're looking for people with a script who want to direct their own movie because we can't afford directors, but we'll let you direct it and we'll give you 50% of it, of the wow. gross. And I said, yeah, okay, because we expect, I thought my mom and a few friends would see it, you know.
Right.
And so one way or the other, what they didn't tell me at the time was that they didn't have the money. They were getting the money as we were making the movie. Like, wow. They had $30,000 when we started. I mean, if I had known that, I would have been a nervous wreck, right. You know, but I had no idea.
And, like, that's a fortune. Like, $1 million for an independent film at that time, it's a fortune.
Like, right.
You're thinking, we're good. We got this.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that if, like you said, the fact you didn't have that, imagine yeah. that anxiety and unease. Oh. Like, that's constantly weighing you the whole
exactly.
time.
Exactly.
Yeah. I love that J.T. Walsh monologue at the start cracks me up.
Oh, yeah, I know, right? J.T. was great.
The story he tells you, like, then the penis comes out, and you're like, oh, yeah. And he goes,
Oh, yeah.
The only downside to Sling Blade, it's the only flaw in the movie, is that every damn person that sees it ends up doing an impression of Carl. And it's always, why is it always fried chicken and taters?
They always mention French fried potatoes. It's like, you know, I don't care really that if people love your movie, they can love it for whatever reason, but it is a little disconcerting to me that, you know, people will come up to me sometimes and say, man, I love Sling Blade. Man, that thing was hilarious. And I'm like, really? So you didn't get the whole religion part and the, you know,
right,
all the underlying themes, I guess, weren't at the top of your list here.
No, I just like when he said to John Ritter, hey, not yeah. funny, haha, funny, queer. Like,
right, exactly. All right,
thanks, buddy.
Yeah, right.
It's not under the comedy section of the
yeah,
things.
Yeah.
I read, today's Martin Scorsese's birthday. Mm. We all love Scorsese, obviously. Yeah. I read he gave you editing tips on Sling Blade. Is that true?
Well, you know, what happened was the studio wanted me to cut it. Once we sold it, you know, mm-hmm. To the distributor for more than I ever dreamed of, mm-hmm. They wanted me to cut the movie down to, you know, they always want you to cut things to an hour.
Hour 20, let's just go.
Exactly.
Leave it all the character development.
And so I sent it to Martin Scorsese on video cassette. And because he was a fan of One False Move, and I'd met him at something once, and he said, if you ever need anything, let me know. He said, you know, you're going to do okay in this business, whatever, you know, kid, that yeah. kind of thing.
Right.
And so I took him up on it, and I don't even think he remembered, you know, probably even meeting me, but
right.
and probably doesn't remember this, but I sent it off to him. I called him up, and I said, you said if, you know, if you could ever help. So I said, they want me to cut this movie. That's you know, my first movie. I'd done a documentary before, but that was it. And I said, would you watch this and tell me if you think it needs cut? And I said, because I would listen to you. Mm-hmm. And it had no music yet or anything. You know, 2 hours and 17 minutes. Mm-hmm. And sent it to him. And I heard back from him a couple of weeks later. And he said, don't cut a frame. And he said, and aside from anything creative, he goes, I personally happen to think this is a great movie, and I think you're going to do very well with it. You may even collect an award for this wow. movie, you know. But he said, the reason I'm telling you this is because right now you're under the radar, you're starting out and everything. He said, this is probably the only time, or only chance you'll ever have in your career to do a movie exactly the way you want to do it. He said, after, once you become a big deal, they'll never leave you alone again. And he was right. Yeah, you'd think it's the other way around.
Right.
But in fact, when they don't care about you yet, that's when they'll let you get by with stuff. And see, the original company, the shooting gallery that gave me the money to make the movie, mm-hmm. or that doled out the money to me to make the movie, they gave me Final Cut. So when we sold it to the distributor, our distributor already had Final Cut. So they couldn't make me cut it.
Right.
And that's why I sent it to Scorsese.
Well, it's amazing because you think about independent filmmakers and guys that have kind of stayed true to their vision. And one of those guys, along with yourself, or a group of people, is the Coen brothers.
Right.
And it's right there with Sling Blade, but The Man Who Wasn't There to me, I think, is your best work. I think it's extraordinary. And it's like you take it personally when you really love an actor. You go, why didn't enough people see that movie? Like, it's a film noir. It's beautifully shot. The dialogue's amazing. The scene with Tony Shalhoub and you, where Freddie Riedenstrahl, I'm an attorney, you're a barber, you don't know anything.
Exactly.
Like Scarlett Johansson when she says to you, like, I get it, you're an enthusiast. No. How did you play? Because I had to imagine as an actor, it's easy. Pacino said this with The Godfather. It's easy to play Sonny because you're fiery and volcanic. It's harder to play Michael because it's inward. Right. That character you play in The Man Who Wasn't There, the barber, is so detached and so taciturn. How were you able to do that?
Well, that was the hardest thing, or at least the thing that was most concerning before doing the movie was how do you do a whole movie where really you're talking in voiceover the whole movie and you're not, you know, you don't have a lot of dialogue. You're just sitting there smoking and looking at people. And one of the things that I do when I'm playing a character that's that inside themselves is that on the set, I'm not that way all the time. In other words, if you're just sitting there, Robert Duvall told me years ago, there's a thin line between subtle and boring. And I think that you've got to, first of all, you have to hold the camera. Uh-huh. And there has to be an intensity inside you in order to do that. And so on the set, I would talk to people right up to the time we say action. I didn't sit in the corner and sulk. That would just keep me in the same spot. So in other words, if it's almost like, you know, they say somebody dies and you see their, you know, something go out of them or whatever, you know, it's like if I've just been sitting around joking with you and we've been talking about football or whatever it is, you know, and then I sit down, they say roll, there's still life going on there. See,
well, you are reading my mind because I watched Monsters Ball obviously years ago, and I remember watching the outtakes and exactly what you're referring to. Same thing I do on set on baseball, or college football. When the director's going 30 seconds or 10 seconds, I'm still talking because I don't like the idea of lights on, cue, and you're shot out of a cannon.
Exactly.
We should already be having a conversation about the car and whatever it is. And the outtake on Monsters Ball is you and Halle Berry driving in a car, and she's just quietly emoting. And you are talking as the character what he'd be saying prior to the dialogue in the movie.
Right.
Meaning you're saying, I'm so sorry about your son. Hopefully we'll get through this. Then they call action, and you're doing what's actually scripted. But you've already had an actual conversation about what the guy would have been saying before you see it.
Right, exactly.
Which is amazing because I can imagine other actors might be unnerved by that. Like, no, I'm in my space, and you're going, no, this is actually helping us get into that mode.
Well, the point of good acting is that you're supposed to be real.
Right.
And I'm of the mind that you don't – I don't know if – I can only use California because I live in California. But if you're – I always looked at acting classes like this. They take you through all these steps – to get to this place. And maybe it works for some people, not for me.
Right.
But I always said this to young actors. I said, if you're in Santa Monica and you want to go to the airport, you don't go from Santa Monica to Glendale to the airport. Just go to the airport.
Right.
It's right over there. you know? And so, you know, I just believe that if you have life experience, mm-hmm. and, you know, you just talk to people like you talk to them without going out in the hallway and yodeling and stuff first, you know, it's, you know.
Well, that's the difference, because then I think some would say, oh, so you mean method acting, but it's not like you're staying in character the whole time.
No.
You're being you.
Yeah. I'm me in every role I play.
Right. So it's not like Carl is inhabiting the set, as pretentious as that sounds.
Yeah. I don't even call characters by their other name usually. It's like who is William? Well, you know, William's the kind of guy, because you're automatically separating yourself from them.
Right.
You're making them a mountain you have to climb. And I just don't believe that. And also, I don't believe that if my dad was like the guy in The Man Who Wasn't There, which, by the way, is my favorite performance I ever did.
Oh, it's extraordinary.
And, you know, it's like, you know, when you're doing these things, you have to kind of keep your life in it. You know, it's like I always tell people my method is started when I was born. You know, if I have a method or a process, it's mm-hmm. like my process was from the time I was born till now. You know, it's not something I concocted.
Right.
And it's like if an actor's playing a street person, let's say, a homeless guy, mm-hmm. and he goes downtown in L.A. and he gets in a cardboard box on Fifth Street, and his security guard's right there in the car, and, you know, his publicist is on the phone with him and stuff, and he spends the night in a cardboard box. You're still not going to know what it's like to be a homeless guy. You know what I mean? If you know that you're going back to Beverly Hills tomorrow,
right.
you're not going to know what it's like to be homeless, you know?
Well, that's the thing. You cut through that pretension, I think, as well as any actor in Hollywood. I don't know, it's maybe because you're from Arkansas and these other guys maybe grew up in a different environment. But I remember the Monsters Ball, again, the commentary. Mark Forster, I'm sure, is a great guy and a good director. But he's using all these ethereal thoughts in the commentary. And you're just like, hey, man, whatever. They just go action and we do it. And you're not trying to be denigrating. You're just like, no. Let's not be I guess don't make it bigger than it is. Like, it's an important story, and I'm happy to be in service of the story. But the guys that get caught in concepts – and they're missing the real substance right. of the art.
Well, people want to believe, like if you do a Q&A with a group of, you know, young filmmakers or whatever, or mm-hmm. critics or whatever they are, it's interesting to them to hear about the process. And it's interesting to hear all the tricks of the trade. People desperately want to believe that there's a formula for everything. Right. And sometimes there's just not. And I believe... For actors, you can either do it or you can't. Mm-hmm. I've never seen an acting coach make a bad actor good. I've seen them make good actors worse.
I'm the same with sports
you
guys.
You know what I mean?
I'll meet young guys and I'll go, okay, I think you have something. You just need to cultivate it. Yeah. I see some that I go, I just don't see it, man.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's not your deal. See, like for instance, people assume that actors can do any other kind of entertainment thing.
Right.
Not true. Not a good public speaker. I could never, like, I'm the wrong guy to host something.
Right.
For instance, I'm too scattered. I have ADD. I'm dyslexic. There's all kind of reasons for me to not be a host.
But you're a musician. Box cutters. You guys are successful. Well, so you have other talents.
Oh, absolutely. Music I grew up in. That's fine. Right. On stage playing music. But I mean, just as a talk show host or like what you guys do.
Right.
I'm a sports guy.
Right.
But Jack Buck got me – Jack Buck and Mike Shannon, because I'm a Cardinal guy, they got me in the booth with them one time at a Cardinal game. And Shannon said, come on, Billy, we're going to have you call an inning. And Jack said, yeah, that'd be good. And Jack looked a little hesitant, but you know, Shannon, you know, he doesn't care.
He's a character.
And they were playing Toronto, I believe it was. And this was in a spring game, you know, and or maybe it wasn't. I remember Ken Seiko was still there. That's all I remember.
Yeah, Malik Six with the Jays briefly. Yep.
But because he came to the plate and they let me call an inning.
How'd you do?
Horrible. I mean, I'm a baseball guy.
Right.
I'm looking at this guy and I go, Jose Canseco comes up to the plate and. And he bats toward the ball and, you know, stuff like that.
Were you saying too much or not enough stuff?
Nothing. I was babbling like an idiot. And I looked at Shannon and said, I can't. You got to do it. You know,
we all have to know our strengths and weaknesses. Bad Santa is one of the funniest movies of this century. Bad Santa 2 is going to be now in theaters. I've seen it. I encourage all of you to go check it out. There was no bigger laugh for me, my brother, and my cousins when the guy comes to your door and wants you to join in the festivities, and you said, "Sorry, we don't celebrate Christmas. We're Muslim." So all of right. me and my family, like, yeah, that's exactly what we used to always say.
Exactly.
But no, hey, we don't celebrate Christmas. We get off our back.
Yeah. You see a reindeer on our roof? Get out of here. Yeah.
So we all love it. I've read that when you got the script, you were like, okay, either this is going to be a gigantic hit or this is it. I'm packing my bags and back to Arkansas.
Exactly.
Why do you think it was able to connect with audiences?
You know, I think it's an alternative to the usual over-sentimental kind of movies, you know.
It's my favorite Christmas movie for that reason.
Well, I mean, you know, people who watch It's a Wonderful Life will watch Bad Santa, too. I think it's just – it's almost like an antidote to all the Christmas syrup, you know. And,
right.
And also, I think Willie says a lot of things to people that we didn't want to in the grocery store sometime, but we don't
–
I'm
on my lunch break.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think everybody wants to, you know, do that every now and then. And I think people can kind of live vicariously through Willie that way. And also something that profane, you just got to – it's like you just – you watch it like a train wreck. It's like, wow, they did this. And the new one's the same way. I mean, we have some stuff, you know, I don't think people will ever look at Japanese food the same.
Yeah. Good to have Tony Cox is back.
Oh, yeah.
God bless, of course, the late John Ritter and Bernie Mac not there. Kathy Bates is fantastic. And that kid's Canadian, by the way. I'm from Toronto, so I looked it up.
He's from Vancouver. Yeah,
Thurman Merman. He still has a hankering for sandwiches. I should
absolutely
say that.
Absolutely, yeah.
Two other things before we let you go. You mentioned Duvall, your relationship with him. How did that happen? He's in Sling Blade.
Right.
You're in The Apostle, which I think is Duvall's masterpiece.
I love that movie, yeah.
And your character plays this racist who ends up coming to the church and has an awakening, so to speak. Right. How'd that develop with Duvall? He's one of the greats, obviously.
I knew Duvall before we did Sling Blade. We had the same agent. Okay. And my agent knew that he was my hero, you know, and he hooked us up a few years before that. And Duvall came to me one time, to Tom Epperson and myself, and he said he liked our writing. Mm-hmm. And Duvall loves Southern literature, you know, and Texas and Faulkner and
right.
Steinbeck, any of that stuff, yeah. And he said, I want you guys to write me a movie where I play a black man. I swear. And I said, well, Bobby, that's kind of a tall order, you know. And he goes, I when I was a kid, there was a black man who had red hair. I swear to God, and I remembered that in my town. And he wanted to play a black man, so we wrote this movie that he and James Earl Jones starred in called A Family Thing.
Yep.
And that was kind of how our relationship started right there, yeah.
That's really cool. Speaking of projects, again, Against the Grain, you were nominated Best Supporting Actor, A Simple Plan. I remember my buddy Mike and I, you know when you see a great movie, you walk and you're just silent afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
It was like an updated version of Treasure of Sierra Madre.
Right.
And your character, Jacob, like there's two things that stick out to me still now. One is when he's impersonating Bill Paxton, and he's doing it because his brother had said to do it. But he's taken real relish in it because he knows it's bugging his brother, and he's not doesn't like the plan.
Exactly.
And two, when Jacob, it's just so heartbreaking, he just says, listen, man, like I've never even kissed a girl before.
Right.
Like, if being rich changes that, I'm all for it.
Yeah.
How do you know those characters? It seems like those outcasts, those guys from the South, you know those people better, I think, than anybody.
I was one more than people know. Yeah. I was kind of, I was raised in the woods and, you know, when we moved into a town that was a bigger town, I was kind of an outcast and, teased as a hillbilly and all this kind of stuff, you know? So I went through all that and I was just this bucktooth kid who never, figured it amount to anything and pretty insecure. Those characters are actually, probably closer to me than anything else. Wow. And the character, that scene you're talking about with Jacob in the car about the girl, that wasn't in the script. That was mine.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And that was an actual story from when I was
a great kid. Actors always bring the material to them. On a sports note, as a diehard Cardinals fan, you mentioned Jack Buck. I just read Joe Buck's book, by the way. It's terrific.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure you know Joe a little bit. But
yeah,
he's great stories about Jack and just how beloved he was in St. Louis. And and for you, I remember one time I'm like, why is Billy Bob from Arkansas a Cardinals fan? But if you were from the South, St. Louis was the most westernmost town for years. So everybody from that region was a Cardinals fan.
Everybody's a Cardinal fan.
So now it makes sense.
And their AA club is in Little Rock, the Arkansas Travelers.
So that's the other part as well.
Exactly.
How painful is it hearing Go Cubs Go? Just
oh, man, it's hard. It's so hard. I mean, you got out of, like, plain human decency, you have to say, okay, it's been a long time. We got to give it to you guys. But the Cardinal in you?
Right.
It's
wait another 180 years.
Right.
I'm tired of this.
Yeah.
Eddie Vedder, get out of here.
Right.
Cusack?
Don't want to hear it. Yeah. Oh, and Cusack's my buddy.
Right.
But I really don't want to talk to him right now.
I could talk to you for hours.
You
Billy
too,
Bob
man.
Thornton, Bad Santa 2. Make sure you check it out in the theaters. It's a rich filmography you put together. I'm glad we were able to be nostalgic about it all.
Me too, man.
So this is the crazy thing. The interview ends, and he looks at me, and he smiles, big smile, and he goes, man, I knew you liked movies, but I didn't know you knew that much. So two things there, Stan. Like, one, he's a legitimate fan. Like, he knew who all of us were. Like, when he walked in, it was like
– let's be clear. He's a legitimate sports fan
right. And
knows you through your work at ESPN. He is not a legitimate fan of the podcast yet.
Yet. But I think – I mean, you were – this is something that was interesting, by the way. Because of a confluence of events, Stanzik was actually in the room with me the entire time. Your reaction to his answers and his whole demeanor.
Oh, I thought you were going to bring up the story how at one point during the interview, I texted you from 3 feet away to let you know that we only had 5 minutes left and that you hadn't gotten to Bad Santa yet.
Yeah, because we dove deep in there as you get the process of acting. It was such good stuff. I didn't want to get him off track, but you're right. Imagine if we'd finished it up and gone, oh, by the way. How about Bad Santa? Oh, we're out of time. Wait, what? You're here promoting Bad Santa 2, and I love Bad Santa. We didn't even get into it. So, yeah, you did text at one point and kind of made a motion with the five. But just a cool dude. We finish it up. I ask for a picture. Stanzik takes a picture. I thank him again, and we give him a Cinephile shirt. He seemed genuinely touched. Oh, thanks a lot, man. Sees the back of it, the Maple Leafs. And I said, you're huge in Canada. I know you shot Fargo in Calgary, which I would have loved to talk to him about Fargo. Obviously, I loved him as Lorne Malvo. And I said, I know you've toured in Saskatchewan. He goes, yeah, my band, the Boxcutters, we've been to Saskatoon. And I said to him then, I'm like, hey, did you ever hear what happened with Gomeshi? And he's going to go. Katie Mirvaldis, who is a wonderful talent producer here, has got to get him to the next spot. Like, all day he's here doing 20 interviews. He's got to get to Rossillo and Connell. And his face lights up, and he goes, man, have I got a story for you. So we start walking, and then Katie goes, okay, you can walk with us. Then he goes into the studio, and then I didn't want to be a jerk to Rossillo and be like, I'm not taking away your time. But Billy Bob goes, wait, I'll tell you that story. So here's the backstory to them, the story that he tells me. If you look up Billy Bob Thornton and Gian Gomeshi online, G-H-O-M-E-S-H-I is the guy's last name. J-I-A-N is his first name. I'm going to say he's like the Carson Daly of Canada. Maybe that's off, but young guy, big music guy, works for CBC. So if you look at the interview, it is cringe-inducing. The entire time, whatever questions he asked Billy Bob cannot be more monosyllabic and just wants to have zero to do with him. He answers questions with a question. So it's really awful to watch. And what happened was the story was that after the interview, Billy Bob and his band, the Boxcutters, played in Toronto and then ended up getting booed afterwards. And apparently he said Canadian audiences, like he took a shot at them. Like it was a big mess, a big kerfuffle. So my cousin Zaha that said to me, he's like, hey, make sure you tell him about Gomeshi. Gian Gomeshi, I can't remember the exact time frame, but within the last year, has been fired, was fired by his job from the CBC, and was charged because with like – sexual, I don't think, again, I feel bad. I don't know the exact story, but it's like sexual battery and such, sexual assault, because, several women filed charges against him. And his defense was that he just likes rough sex. Apparently, handcuffs women, slaps them, punch them, beat them, like horrific stuff. But his argument is that it was consensual and he got off. He was not, he didn't actually serve any time for this, but his career is over. I have no idea who the hell is going to hire him again. His name, if you say his name in Canada, everyone immediately knows, oh, yeah, the guy who was beating women and getting away with it. So it's a horrible, horrible story. So my cousin was like, just let Billy Bob know, like, hey, does he know what happened to this guy? Like, so when I said that, he goes, well, I have a story for you. I'm like, oh, God. So Billy Bob walks to that for his guy. So here's what happened. He goes, we go do the interview, and I tell his producer, hey, listen. And I saw on the prompter, he had Academy Award-winning actor Billy Bob Thornton. And Billy Bob says to the producer, hey, listen, I'm here with my buddies. Can you just introduce each of them first? And then after that, if you want to talk movies, that's totally cool. Like, I get it. The people are coming to see the band because of my name. But I'm here with my buddies. Like, just mention their names first, that we're the Boxcutters. And then, whatever. The lead is Billy Bob Thornton. And that's fine. Bruce goes, all right. He said at the start of the interview, when Gomeshi, he goes, the look in his eye. Billy Bob goes, I'm like, no, I know. He goes, when someone's just kind of get at you. He goes, the way he looked at me, and he started the interview with Academy Award winning actor Billy Bob Thornton. He goes, he's just sneering at me. So Pele Blanco, because at that point, I'm like, no, yeah, screw this guy. So that's why I purposely checked out for the interview. I'm like, if you're going to be a jerk to me, I'll be a jerk right back to you. And I said, did you get booed the next time? He goes, here's the other thing. He goes, but we had a great crowd in Toronto. He goes, there was like six people up in the balcony that booed. And all of a sudden, the next day in the paper, it was like, oh, Canadians hate Billy Bob Thornton's band. They booed him because of this interview with Kamesh. He goes, fast forward a couple years ago. He goes, I'm in Los Angeles. I'm leaving a hotel, and there this guy is. And he comes up to me and goes, hey, we should probably clear this up, like what happened. It wasn't good for either of us. And Billy Bob's like, all right. He goes, so they start talking about music, and he has a grudging respect for him. And Kamesh goes, listen, I'm writing a book. I want you to write the foreword for it. It's about anxiety and some of my issues. Bill goes, all right, you know, maybe I'd like to do that. I don't know, but let me think about it. He said, then he hears about this story that he's in jail for beating women, and he goes, see, I knew it. I told you this guy was an a-hole all along. So I was like, you are a great interview. Do not believe just because of some interview with John Gomeshi that Billy Bob is not a wonderful human being. He's like, I know. I go, I'm going to tell this story. He's like, do whatever you want with it. He goes, that's what happened. Oh, it's such a great guy, man. He was, like I said, he was funny. He was entertaining. I really thought he was into it, what we were talking about. I went back. I don't know. Sanjay, you have not seen The Man Who Wasn't There.
No. You guys geeked out pretty hard about it, though.
Yeah, I mean, this is a movie set in the 1940s, black and white film about a barber and a film noir. Like, it's not a well-known film, but as you heard him say, he said, I think that's my best work and the work that I'm proudest of. He also mentioned it in the Le Batard show, and they said, what character do you most love? And he goes, oh, The Man Who Wasn't There. I played Ed Crane, this barber. So happy to have that mutual appreciation that he was proud of his work, and I think his work is exceptional in that movie. I went back and watched it again the other day. I love that film. Just look up The Man Who Wasn't There. Even the trailer for it's amazing. The way it's shot by Roger Deakins, so good. The bad news is this. I saw Bad Santa 2, and it is a disappointment. So there's the other issue. The guy is a phenomenal guy. Could not have been a better human being. And now I have to tell you that with my integrity as a faux film critic, the movie was a disappointment. Now, the original Bad Santa, I think, Stanzik, it's not one of these comedies that's like just a joke a minute. I think the premise is just so funny, and Willie is such a great character that the humor all stems from him. So, and the freshness of it, as he said in the interview, that I think people loved it because he's reacting to all these, you know, Miracle on 34th Street and all that kind of stuff, and that Willie just doesn't care. He goes, like, how can you not like a character like that? So with Bad Santa 2, the novelty's worn off. You know exactly what Willie's like. And with comedy sequels, unfortunately, what happens, and this is what I think Bad Santa 2 falls privy to, is just more of the same without being fresh. So you've lost the novelty now. Now it's just increasingly vulgar, increasingly coarse, you know, without having the elements of being new. And plus, I really think this one misses John Ritter and Bernie Mac, of course, who both passed on, who are both so great in the original. Kathy Bates plays his mom. And she's all right. I think Kathy Bates is a good actress. Obviously, she's funny, and she gets it. Like, she's an actress who's unafraid to, you know, dive right into the vulgarity and such. And she plays Willie's mom, and they, whatever. I don't want to give away the plot, but they're basically, you know, back together again with Tony Cox. But unfortunately, yeah, the movie falls a little bit flat. But because Billy Bob's an awesome guy, go out and see Bad Santa 2 anyways. Make up your own mind. Maybe I'm completely off on this, but I have such high expectations for Bad Santa.
Let the record show that way back when I had a internal newsletter here at ESPN Radio, ESPN Audio Times, I asked you to rank your top three Christmas movies once. And number one on that list was Bad Santa. And my father saw it and was appalled. Because the last time we had Stanzik family Christmas movie, it was Bad Santa, and we have never gone again as a family.
But you and your brothers loved it.
Oh, it's hysterical, of course.
The thing is, I'm big on my favorite member of the Stanzik family, Jim Stanzik, of course, who is an avid listener cinephile. Moore and Elizabeth, the twins are good. Mom, I'm, you know, whatever. Dad is a good human being. The way you've described your dad, he's a phenomenal human being. So if ever I get the pleasure of meeting Mr. Stanzik, the first thing I will say, listen, sir, I'm sorry that you and I differ on Bad Santa. What is his favorite? It's not like the ref, I'm going to guess. It's probably
favorite Christmas movie? I don't know.
It's a wonderful
life. He likes,
though,
like Jumanji is his kind of – oh, he loves the barbershop films. Loves them. Like, to a level I can't even understand.
For those wondering, Stanzik is indeed white, and his father is white. So, yes, it's a little bit surprising. This white man from Syracuse loves the barbershop movies. If you tell me he loves, like, Madea, we have another issue on our hands.
He likes Papillon?
Yeah, Steve McQueen. Okay. All right, back in. Papillon, excellent. All right, coming up next, we have Miles Teller. So Miles and I go way back to our days at Celebrity Softball, which has been a real boon here for Cinephile. Terry Crews, J.K. Simmons, Miles Teller. Three of our first 15 guests I all know previously
because I do play-by-play for celebrity softball for ESPN. All three of those guys have played in it. So that already helped break the water here with Miles. He talks about his film Bleed for This and also his Eagles fandom and other issues. I'll give you a review of Bleed for This in a second. But first, listen to the interview with a really exciting young actor, Miles Teller. You're listening to Cinephile, the Adnan Virk movie podcast, and a real thrill to have Miles Teller here with us in studio. Miles and I go way back. We met at last year's Celebrity Softball.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember. I don't have the box score saved, but I think you went 2 for 3, a couple of infield singles.
Yeah, which is embarrassing. I mean, dude, I was playing varsity baseball as a sophomore growing up, but right. Slow pitch, it's a different game. But yeah, an infield single in the celebrity softball game, you're never proud. I was just bummed I actually had to like beat it out. I never wanted to have to beat it out in that game. I thought I was going to be hitting dingers, and it just didn't happen.
I think what it was is you were apprehensive by the size of the crowd, because you said to me, like, are they going to be full here in Cincinnati? I'm like, we're expecting 30,000 for this.
You know, as that was one of the coolest. I had been to the Oscars at that point in my career. I said, and this was cooler. For sure. I mean, I'd always dreamed about that. I'd always dreamed about, like, being – I mean, I guess back in the day they had, like, Rock and Jock, but just being on an actual stadium
right,
and playing on the field that these guys play in. It's – how many people get that experience as just fans is incredible.
J.K. Simmons played this year.
Yeah.
So as soon as I saw him, I said, you know, Miles was here last year. He's like, yeah, where is that
I know. Okay, so now I know what kind of vocabulary we're working with on this show. J.K. Simmons.
I was just astonished that was the right where he went to. He's like, yeah. Like, not like, hey, where's Miles, my buddy? He was like, boom.
Yeah, that's, I don't know. He's like the stepfather I wish I'd never met. But somehow we're just, we're linked for life.
Yeah, I mean, he owes you, and I don't mean this sarcastically, he owes you in small part with the Oscar because of how good you guys work together in Whiplash.
Yeah.
And I know
anytime you win supporting actor, usually the lead actor had something to do with it.
Right. So, like, his victory is also a victory for you. You can never let him forget that. Like, hey, whatever you say, JK, I was the lead of Whiplash. It was a Best Picture nominee.
Yeah. He's, I don't know. I think he's looking for one more great ride before he goes off into the sunset, and I keep telling him, I'm busy. Figure it out.
Yeah, when are they going to reteam? We'll let you know, JK.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I'm pretty busy.
He really did enjoy, like, taunting you and belittling you. I'm like, yeah, what actor wouldn't? Like, how much fun would that be? Like, Damien Chazelle's like, all right, you want to just torture Miles again today? Like, yeah, we're going to do that again.
Yeah, pretty much. I don't know. I'm sure there's been a couple co-stars of mine that would have enjoyed that opportunity. But in reality, and you'll never hear this from JK, the set was actually a lot of fun.
Right.
JK's a baseball guy. I'm a baseball guy.
Yeah, he's a Tigers fan.
It's, you know, baseball's a different sport. I feel like if your dad didn't teach it to you, mm-hmm. then you probably missed it. But baseball fans, they just kind of, I don't know, there's a certain, there's just a certain dialogue that they use that's different from other sports. But we were laughing on set. It's just absurd because I was like 25 at the time and he's slapping me in the face. Or maybe I was like, yeah, exactly. He's like, slap me in the face. And this guy I'm having these conversations with about the Tigers and Phillies on action, he slapped me and I'm having to like drop a single tear because it calls for it in the script. Are you one of those single tier? I'm like, oh my God, I literally have to drop a tier right now.
And then it's like, hey, what do you think about Jimmy Rollins? You like what he had Scott Rowland?
Oh, Scott Rowland. I've not heard that name in so long.
Classic Phillies, because you're 29, so like your Phillies fandom, like Ryan Howard, obviously.
Yeah, later, like even but my first team was that 93 team. Darren Dalton's my favorite player. Kruk, Mika Morandini, Kevin Stocker, Eisenreich, Incaviglia, Dykstra, Ricky Bitalico. Those Mitch Williams, those are my guys.
That's all one.
Charlie Hayes, before he was catching that out for the Yankees.
I don't want to remind you, but being from Toronto, 93, Joe Carter.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I thought that was the year of the strike, but it's maybe that was 94. I don't know.
I do love the fact that, like, fandom, the way it's created, just what you did, you can literally rhyme off the exact batting order or whatever of your youth.
I remember we were talking
hockey. You were like, oh, Flyers, Lindros.
Yeah, Legion
just
of Doom.
Like, yeah, that stuff.
Snow and Hextall and Brindamore and Joel Otto. And, yeah, all those. I don't even really I haven't really followed hockey that much lately. But, yeah, I mean, Philly's such – I mean, the Phillies are honestly probably third in that town. It's Eagles And then Flyers too. It's a huge hockey town. And then when the Phillies won in 2008, because we had been bottom of the barrel for, you know, for so long.
Right.
That was there's a sports bar in New York called Wogie's.
Okay.
That's a Philly sports
bar.
That's right. Good cheesesteaks. And I watched them win the World Series there. I cried. Because it's like, if I know, and I tell my girlfriend this, because I'll be in the airport, somebody will have a hat on. Sports is just, it's, you know, you just instantly, I don't care if I know nothing else about you, and I see you wearing a Phillies hat, we both love that. And so I like you.
Right.
If I don't, you could be a terrible person, you could be a terrible human being, but I'll be able to, you know, have a conversation with you and enjoy your company for a little bit.
That's the greatness of fandom. You're listening to Cinephile, the Adnan Virk movie podcast. We're talking with Miles Teller. Your journey, for those who are unaware, at NYU, in your own words, you smoked a ton of pot.
Yeah.
Having said that, you lived the lifestyle that
is now legal in a lot of states. So
nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But this is amazing. How soon after graduation did you get that role with Nicole Kidman in Rabbit Hole?
So I got a manager pretty much right before my senior year, which NYU actually doesn't really advocate. They don't want you to start working professionally. They think while you're in school, focus on school and then have the business come to you afterwards. But I don't know. I got a manager, started auditioning, and I booked Rabbit Hole. I was doing an NYU student film maybe like 2 weeks before I graduated, and then I got the call saying that I just booked this part. And you go from only doing things with your peers, I'm only doing scenes with guys and girls my own age, to then, boom, 3 weeks later, I was on set with John Cameron Mitchell and Nicole Kidman and Aaron Eckhart, and no rehearsal, which is something I love now. But at the time, I was like, what do you mean that we don't get to practice this first? And man, you're just in a scene with Nicole. And even now, it's like I was just at the Governor's Awards, and everybody that you can think of is at this thing. And I still – and me and Nicole have known each other for a couple of years now. But, yeah, man, you still work with people that you just kind of grew up with, or it's hard to not see them as something bigger than themselves. You know, just it's hard to – now I'm better at it. But, you know, for me, those first couple takes, I remember just really feeling an out-of-body experience. Oh, dude, that's our Sports Center spot running right now.
Oh, look at that. That's right. You're on – wait a second. You're with Joe Tessitore right now on these ESPN commercials.
Thank God. There's Vinny.
Vinny Pazienza. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, it's nice to break up this Giants going to make the Super Bowl crap.
A lot of talk today on ESPN. How much ESPN do
what
you
the
want?
What are the Giants, 5-4?
6-3.
Oh, 6-3?
Beat the Bengals 21-20 on Monday Night Football.
Yeah. yeah, I don't know. I couldn't believe we lost to him.
But the Eagles great at home, like big win. Just
well, undefeated at home, yeah.
Right.
We're great at home. Had a 10 point lead in the fourth quarter against the Cowboys at home.
Yeah, it was painful.
But it's
what
like,
do you hate more,
what
do
you do?
Cowboys or Giants?
You know, it's funny. So for my uncles, you know what I mean? It's like everybody hates Dallas. And that's because, for a long time, you know, Dallas was winning all those years. For me personally, in my generation, I was talking about it the other day. I'm like, I hate the Giants. Mm-hmm. A, my buddy's a Giants fan, and I just.
Buddies always make it worse.
Oh, my God. Chirping. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, chirping. But, you know, they've won 2 Super Bowls, and they've kind of been the team, even though they're not putting up the numbers, wins and losses.
Right.
Eagles averaged 10 wins a season, I think, with Andy Reid.
Yep.
Giants are getting these Super Bowls, so I hate the Giants.
Yeah, it's pretty frustrating.
Some people will tell me I need to play Peyton Manning in a biopic someday. And then some people say I look like Eli Manning.
Stacey, you like that pick?
Yeah.
You think Miles looks like Peyton? I think Miles is a little more sophisticated,
you know,
more handsome than Peyton.
Hey, what are you going to do? But I'm saying that's why you
forehead not as big.
Sometimes you stay off Twitter
for good reason.
Yeah, exactly.
Bleed for this. I was apprehensive before I saw it because I go, another boxing movie. Like, we've had so many of these. I get why actors want to play it. First and foremost, you were in phenomenal shape in this movie.
Thank you.
You were in good shape when I met you a year ago. But like, what did you have to do? Like salmon and broccoli, 1,200 calories a day? Like, you're shredded in this movie.
Yeah, it's funny because me and Michael B., we were both doing Michael B. Jordan.
Right.
So we did Creed, and we were both filming Fantastic Four at the time that we were training for our boxing movies because we were both supposed to start right after Fantastic Four.
Yeah.
So Mike was bulking up. He was eating, mounds of, healthy food, but mounds of it. And I was just, I had to put on what's called lean muscle mass. So I had to lose weight while also building muscle. So I dropped 20 pounds, got down to 6% body fat. And I was, that's just to get you in the door. You know, visually you have to look like a boxer for people to buy it.
Right.
Then you got to box like the guy, and then you got to handle yourself like a a boxer. And Vinny also moved up three weight classes. That was part of his legacy. He won titles at lightweight and junior middle, which Roberto Duran was the only guy to do it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But we're filming in 24 days. So I started at 168 for the first fight. And then by the last fight, I gained 15 pounds back in about 2.5 weeks.
Oh, man. Yeah.
But that was fun because we're in Providence. I don't know if anybody's been there, but
yeah,
I'm sure somebody's been there. But I don't know if you've been there. And it's like, I don't know if anyone's ever been there. It's
tourism
just like,
of Providence. Yeah.
But they have this area called Federal Hill, and yes, they have a really proud Italian-American community with some incredible food that for a while I was just staring at. Even in the movie, all the pasta scenes, like I had to spit it out.
Oh.
I just was like, very strict calories.
Well, like I said, what I love about the movie was, A, it's based on the true stories. You mentioned Vinny Paz, yeah, which I didn't know. Like, I'm a sportscaster. I know boxing, and I've never heard of Vinny Paz. And it reminded me a lot of ways of The Fighter. You touched on the fact there's that strong Italian-American element in the film, and
the
particularly
family.
Punk Robin. It's like, it reminded me much in the way The Fighter was, working-class guy, and it's focusing on his life story and how he overcomes that. Also, again, to the physicality, you had to have that halo on all the time.
Yeah.
I remember a dude in high school had one of those, and like my heart went out to him. How did you do
brutal.
That day after day filming? Awful.
Yeah, it's brutal.
There's a scene where your girlfriend's trying to kiss you, and it's like, no, don't worry about it. It's fine. Like,
yeah, Vinny wouldn't use the term girlfriend. She's just one of the birds. She's one of the birds that's around.
Right.
That was funny. When I was reading the script, every scene it was a different girl's name, and I felt like I kept forgetting the name because I was like, oh, it's good. I didn't know about him. And then I realized, no, it's a different girl with Vinny every scene.
Right.
It's just who he is. But, yeah, we, you know, this metal halo, cause if you guys who don't know, Vinny broke his neck in basically the prime of his career.
Mm-hmm.
And when he got this halo put on, he didn't want to – he wasn't just going to relax in it. He continued to work out, and he started trying to bench press 5 days after breaking his neck.
Yeah.
Which is brutal. But, yeah, I mean, the girl, basically, we got it from a hospital, put it on my head. If it was a studio, I've had more fittings for shoes in movies than I did on this. It was an independent film. So she got it from a hospital, put it on my head once, and we said, okay, this will work in theory.
Yeah.
Show up on set, and we realized the thing wants to move around a lot, but we couldn't, you know, we didn't really have any options. So we just put little rubber pieces on the end of each of the four screws and just put it in my head. Kind of like a vice, and just put it in as tight as we could so that it wouldn't move.
The scene that is wrenching is when the doctor takes it off, and Vinny says, "I don't want any drugs." And
you
go, "Doc,
true.
You're going the wrong way."
Lefty loosey, Doc, you're going the wrong way.
He goes, no, it hurts. It feels like it's screwing in because it's calcified.
It calcifies around the bone. I was just talking to Field Yates, and she was saying she worked in, I think, physical therapy. And
Stefania Bell.
Yeah, Stefania Bell.
Field's a little effeminate, but he's...
Yeah, sorry. Okay. We had our New York premiere last night, and I went to bed about 4 a.m.
So good, Miles.
I'll be transparent here. But yeah, it was tough, but also I talk about, it was difficult, but as an actor, and that's why I do enjoy these movies where you can be pretty obsessive and, you know, really throw yourself into these roles because there is a safety net there. We don't actually pay the consequences for these things. We get to kind of relive these moments and yeah, they can be really tough and challenging, but at the end of the day, you get to go, you know, you go home. We have a fight coordinator. You know, you just have all of these things around you. So I don't. With that being said, it was tough, but it's nothing when you think about what Vinny did in real life with it. It's insane.
Even with your life, the parallels here as far as the car accident, because in Whiplash is a critical scene with a car accident. Obviously, with Vinny, it completely changed his life. And you had a crazy car accident growing up. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I did. I was in a pretty severe car accident when I was 20 years old. My buddies and I, we were coming back from a music festival in Connecticut. It was in Bridgeport. It's called Gathering of the Vibes.
Oh, man.
Where are my deadheads at? Am I right?
Bad memories of Connecticut.
Yeah. Levon Helm on the drums.
If he had said name one city in Connecticut, I would have been like, oh, I'm going to go to Bridgeport.
Yeah, it's exactly a hot spot for kind of deadheads and jam bands. So we were driving back from that, and my buddy lost control of my car. Going, you know, like the speed limit on I-95, it was like 75. So he lost control going 80 miles per hour on a major highway. So we went across three lanes of traffic, back across, went to the grass median, flipped 8 times. I flew out the window and the car landed straight up. And my buddy was driving, my buddy in the backseat, car landed straight up and it kind of come to and look in the front seat, and I'm not there. My buddy goes, where's Miles?
Oh.
My best friend in the back's like, oh, my God, and gets out of the car and looks around for me and sees me, and I'm just laying, like, 40 feet from the car, unconscious, covered in blood. You know, he looked at me and thought I was dead. And, yeah, I mean, I remember him walking up to me, and I look at him, and I say, hey, man, what happened? He goes, we just got in a car accident. Oh, man, my mom's going to be so pissed. I can't believe I just wrecked my car. And I try and sit up, and he just looked at me and said, Miles, don't sit up. You're hurt. You're hurt really bad. And the look on his face let me – so then I remembered where I was at, but and I was thinking, oh, my God, I've been ejected. Thinking all the things that come along with that, I couldn't feel my legs at the time. I literally thought I was paralyzed. And it was overwhelming, so I blacked out and woke up in a hospital.
That's unreal.
Yeah, take that, J.K. Simmons, you What have you done?
Right, like you said.
What have you done, J.K.?
But you think that a lot of people, if you grew up – you grew up in Florida, that people just have car accidents. Like, it's always a –
my
not to your level, obviously.
Yeah, not to this level, but it was – well, yeah, it was on – I looked, yeah, in the town I grew up in. I mean, this happened kind of on the freeway, but the town I grew up in is a small country town.
Yeah.
And, yeah, just a lot of dark back roads, and I lost – two of my best friends in car accidents less than a year after my car accident, like 5 weeks from each other. And it's just, yeah, it's sad, but there's kind of like every year there's going to be one or two kids that goes to a local high school that pass away in a car accident.
Miles Teller, before we finish up here, I do want to ask about War Dogs. I thought it was fantastic. And what I liked about it was it reminded me of like what a Scorsese movie would be.
Yeah.
Like the sense of adrenaline and the music, and you and Jonah Hill, both supercharged performances. Like,
yeah.
It was almost as if like you would adapt Goodfellas to like a younger generation and there were arms dealers instead of gangsters.
Well, these guys were. I mean, this character that Jonah had, it's so
inspired
rare.
Inspired by Scarface.
Yeah, and it's just so rare to get a character at that age. I mean, I think that's what we're always – for me, I just feel like I'm biding my time in my 20s, but you really get your good parts in 30s and 40s.
Right.
But for Jonah to have a character in his 20s who's just does not give a and is pulling out guns in the middle of the day and doing all these things that these guys, you know, did. They're the biggest international arms dealers in the world as a couple of 23-year-old stoners. You know, it's really the power that they had at that age is
right.
It was unbelievable. But yeah, Todd Phillips is an incredible filmmaker.
Yeah, what he did obviously with The Hangover, and now he did with this film, which is comedy and also echoes the drama as well. Go check out Bleed for this. It's a terrific new film in theaters this Friday. Miles Teller, when you think about best actors under 30, I think you're one of them.
Cool.
I mean, you're 29 years old.
Well, I'm turning 30 and February, so.
All right, best actor in Hollywood under 30, Miles Teller, for at least
right
a few
now,
months longer.
Get it while it's hot, because in 2 months, he's one of 30 actors good under 40.
Before I forget, because I know this is your first time at ESPN, I got a T-shirt. This is our podcast.
Oh, cool.
And since I'm Canadian, I rank
Thank
movies
you.
At a Maple Leaf, so then you get your four Maple Leafs here. So.
Okay.
We're going to be the only people that give you a present. You're going to go back to your girlfriend. How was ESPN? This guy gave me a
shirt. I just worked with Taylor Kitsch. He's Canadian, so I'll wear this with pride. Around him and thank you. This is an extra small.
No, that's a large.
I know. I was like,
you get an extra large if you want.
I look small on screen and Whiplash, but I'm actually pretty ripped here, buddy.
Well, Kevin Hart was furious. He was like, you don't have an extra small. I'm like, we only have larges and XLs.
Wow.
He refused to tweet out the podcast because of that. I'm like, hang on a second. Just because the shirt didn't fit.
Unreal. I tell you what, man. I'm going to tweet out this podcast regardless of the size shirt I get because I don't value things in that manner.
Take that to the bank, Miles Teller. Thanks.
Thank
man.
You. Appreciate it.
All right, so Miles, as you can tell, he's a good guy. He's a funny guy. He does not take himself too seriously. By the way, as I mentioned there in the podcast, the Big Eagle sweatshirt on, so clearly wearing his fandom on his sleeve, was really appalled by the covers the Giants were getting because won that game on Monday night. He's like, what, Giants Super Bowl bound? Come on. So he does sound like a typical Eagles fan in that respect. The good news is this. Bleed for This is a surprisingly good movie. As I said to him, I was pleasantly surprised because I just feel like, you know, how many more boxing movies can we have? That market is so oversaturated. But I think, you know, even if a story is well-worn but it's told well, that it has appeal. And that's what happens with Bleed for This. I did not know the true story of Vinny Pazienza, and he's this, you know, up-and-coming boxer from working-class Rhode Island, large Italian-American family, who's on his way up and then suffers this terrible car accident and then has to work his way back to the top. And I've seen some reviews. The critics are always so smarter than I am. One of them said it's like Million Dollar Baby with a happy ending. I'm like, yeah, that's kind of a way you can describe it. Goes in the hospital, ends up coming back in, does win a fight, was a boxer. But Teller's commitment is really what stands out in the movie. You know, he was humble about saying, listen, I'm an actor. It's not like I've got to wear the halo 24/7. It's not like I actually have screws in my head. But honestly, his performance really kind of sells the movie, and so does Aaron Eckhart, who plays his trainer. If I had more time, Miles would ask. Aaron Eckhart got to be wearing like a fat suit because just the way he put on like a big gut. I'm like, Aaron Eckhart, he looks like 40 pounds heavier, shaved his head, just to play the role. But he's a really good actor, and I thought, again, he nailed that part. So check out Bleed for this. Like I said, I understand if you're apprehensive going, really, another sports movie, another boxing movie, but I thought it had a real authenticity about it. And the director, Ben Younger, if you like the movie Boiler Room, he hasn't done a whole lot, but I think a lot of young men our age love Boiler Room. And he did that movie, which I think was 2005 now. He hasn't worked a whole lot. 2009, I believe he did Prime. So he hasn't done a ton, but that the Younger style is like very kind of, you know, obviously look at Boiler Room, very masculine, very intense, and Bleed for This carries through with that as well. So check out Bleed for This, and our thanks to Miles Teller for coming by. I want to give a thought, too, about a movie called Moonlight. If you're a real movie geek or you check out my work on goldderby.com, you know that it's getting significant Oscar buzz right now. The way we have it right now is Moonlight's going to be nominated for Best Picture, and Mahershala Ali is going to be nominated for Best Supporting Actor. In fact, he might be the favorite right now. And it's a really good film. I'm giving it three. By the way, the reviews, Bad Santa 2, we'll give it 2 Maple Leafs. Bleed for This, we're giving 3 Maple Leafs. And Moonlight, I'm giving 3 Maple Leafs. Currently on Rotten Tomatoes, it has like a 98% ranking. So it almost sounds like I'm one of the few who's not overwhelmingly in favor of it. But it's a story. It's told in three parts about a young black boy who's coming to terms with his sexuality. So the first section is just a really little guy. And he was befriended by Mahershala Ali, who plays a drug dealer who has a conscience and kind of looks out for him. And there's one scene at the dinner table that's just fantastic because the little boy asks the drug dealer who's kind of, you know, taking on this parental role with him. He goes, hey, what is this? And it's a famous gay slur. You all know what it is. He says, what does this mean? And the look on Mahershala Ali's face, like, you know, you're a kid. How do you know what that word means? He's like, well, why are you asking me? He's like, oh, that's all the kids at school call me. He's like, is that what I am? And he's like, no, I mean, no one should be called that. That's a bad name for someone. But if you are what that name is suggesting, you know, that I mean, that's cool. Like, I got no issue with that. And the kid's like, oh, okay. And then he asks him some other questions. And there's a real vulnerability to this kid who doesn't, you know, understand the world. And the second chapter of his life now takes place in high school. And now he's really getting mistreated and mocked by his friends. And it taps into the fact that, you know, if you ask people about gay culture, let's say specifically if you're black and gay, you know, you've got two strikes against you, so to speak, and that the way that people are coming at you with prejudice. And if you're in the wrong situation, you know, you're facing discrimination within your own community. You know, try being Jamaican and telling someone that you're gay. Like, go to that country and outwardly say that, and you'll see what kind of reaction you get. So Moonlight does an excellent job of showing what that world is like and really a story that hasn't been told until now. And I think that's why, you know, critics are certainly jumping on it saying, go see this movie. We don't see stories about these people, young black gay kids growing up in inner city. That you hear the inner city part. You hear about black kids. We don't hear about the black gay kids and what their life must be like and what kind of torture they go through. The third chapter then shows the kid what he's like as an adult. And that's a real surprise because early on you go, okay, I see where this is going. He's being tortured. He's being tormented. I see where this is winding up. I won't give anything away, but the third chapter, you're really surprised when you see what this young boy who becomes a high school kid who now is a grown man, what he's now become. And it's actually really quite sad when you see the tragedy within it, but in a way that is very surprising. Barry Jenkins is the director. He's getting a lot of hype for this. He's going to be nominated for Best Director. So if you really like films, art house circuit, so to speak. You like your Oscar bait, go check out Moonlight. I'm giving it 3 Maple Leafs. Mahershala Ali, terrific. He's going to be nominated for Best Supporting Actor. He's a really terrific actor, and it's good to see him getting some love.
A Scorsese story.
Silence is Marty's new movie. It's coming out December 23rd. Has not screened anywhere yet, as Matt Atchley told us of Rotten Tomatoes last time. But if you love Martin Scorsese like I do yourself a favor and go check out the New York Times Magazine. The cover is The Passion of Martin Scorsese. The article is by Kevin Ely, and it is sensational. He interviews Marty at his townhouse in New York after a busy day of editing Silence in Midtown, then goes back to his townhouse. I think it's on the East End. And just sits in Scorsese's living room and just has a conversation with him. And he even describes like the room. He's like, it's exactly what you expect. Like, it's all like Jean Renoir movie posters from the 40s and like French films. And then he shows him like stuff that he has in his house, all this memorabilia. But he talks about faith and he says how, you know, in all your films, you always have faith. Notably, Last Temptation of Christ and Kundun. But even Taxi Driver is a really a movie about faith because Travis sees himself as this avenging angel who's going to save this woman. You know, and he sees his own salvation as self-sacrifice. I'm going to put myself out there, kill all the thugs, wash all the scum and filth off the streets, and end up sacrificing myself for the greater good. And Silence is a story about Jesuit missionaries who faced unreal discrimination in 17th century Japan. I was reading the article. I don't want to know anything about the movie. You know, I haven't even seen a trailer for it yet. So they start to describe specific scenes. I tried to skip ahead a little bit. But Adam Driver, who I don't know a lot of his work, but he was in Star Wars, plays the bad guy. He's also in Girls, Lena Dunham's show. Lost 51 pounds for this movie. And the guy's already thin to begin with. Apparently, Arkley said he's like 170. He's like 5'8", 170. And he lost 51 pounds. So, like, it was unreal, like, the level that this guy went through. 8 months of shooting in Taiwan. Andrew Garfield's the main actor. He said, "You're so intimidated because it's Scorsese, and then he puts you totally at ease because he has so much faith in you. It's like going to film school. He gives you a bunch of movies to watch before you even look at the script to go, all right, this is your homework. Go watch these and figure out all of this stuff." Liam Neeson's in the movie as well. They said to make it, it was originally when Marty first got the script, it was on Boxcar Bertha, I believe. He got it there. Maybe it wasn't Boxcar Bertha. I think that was actually Last Temptation. Forgive me. But whenever he got the book, it took him – it's 27 years from now until actually making the film when he first read the book Silence. I can't wait to read the book. Apparently, it's awesome. But, I did this with Shutter Island. I read the book first when I heard Marty was making the movie, and then I watched the movie. And I like Shutter Island, but I think I would have liked the movie more if I didn't know the ending. I already knew what was going to happen, what was going to happen with Leo. So this time I'm like, no. Watch December 23rd, you're going to see the movie. December 24th, you're going to go see it again. Christmas Day, you're going to see it a third time. Then go out, buy Silence, and read the book and see how good a job they did of capturing it. Because Jay Cox, Marty's longtime friend, is the one who adapted the book. Liam Neeson said that they all worked for scale. In fact, the direct quote of Neeson said with regards to his salary was a pittance. And he said, "We had no issue with it." Because he has a small role in Gangs of New York, but he goes, "Listen, to work with Marty, we all do it for free. Like, Andrew Garfield will make another amazing Spider-Man. He makes his money there. I'll make another Taken. That's where I make my money. Same thing Jonah Hill said. Wolf of Wall Street, it's fine. I'll make my comedies, and I'll make my money there. To work with Marty, we'll do it for free." And Scorsese himself waived a fee, did not make any money for making Silence. So check out Kevin Ellie's article about Marty, The Passion of Martin Scorsese. It is a really good read, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what's going to be coming out. We got lots of good movies on the way. So this is the time, the last 6 weeks of the year, I feel like the buzz is really building for quality films. So I think Cinephile will definitely be a destination here. As always, I'm Adnan Amberg. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you at the movies.
Don't miss out on the next episode of Cinephile. Subscribe to the Adnan Amberg Movie Podcast by clicking the Listen tab in the ESPN app.